Voices and Events. The National Broadcasting Company brings you Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You'll hear Captain John Crommelin and Navy Secretary Matthews, Defense Secretary Johnson, William Green, David Lilienthal, Jimmy Durante, these and many others, the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Now here's your editor for Voices and Events, James Fleming.
From the corridors of the Pentagon to the cocktail lounges of Washington hotels, the argument raged. The Navy versus the Air Force. The mighty B-36, pride of the Air Force, under fire from the Navy. And so was the strategy that the big ship symbolized. Not invincible, said the Navy. Indeed, the B-36 is at the mercy of swift jet fighters. In brief, that's how the week's big news story could be told. But there was more, much more. Perhaps it began when a Navy flyer, Captain John Crommelin, deliberately jeopardized his career to speak out against a strategy he thought weakened his branch of the service. In the face of censure by his superiors, John Crommelin released to newsmen documents by high naval officers echoing his beliefs. And when Crommelin met with newsmen, he often found himself answering impertinent questions like this.
It's been bandied about quite freely since your original statement that your war service, although quite honorable, knocked a few screws loose. Have you ever been examined by a psychiatrist?
No, sir, not since I first took my examination for flight training back in 1925.
And you were all right then?
I think so.
I've been told that you have indicated to some of your friends you would welcome a court-martial because it would give you a chance to tell your story.
I don't know who told you that, sir, but...
That is not correct.
I wouldn't welcome any court-martial, no, sir.
And I'm not
afraid of one, but I don't welcome one. I don't ask for one.
Well, I understand that. But I understand also that you have been anxious to appear before the House Committee in order to tell your story.
I was anxious to appear so that I could tell my story or that some naval officers could tell
it. I'll give you a view.
I much prefer the senior officers in the Navy to be able to appear, sir.
And appear they did. On Capitol Hill, the House Armed Services Committee decided it was time to look into this raging controversy. Committee Chairman Vinson of Georgia summoned Navy Secretary Matthews.
Let the committee come to order.
Better be careful.
Is Secretary Matthews here this morning? Mr. Secretary, come sit up here at the table. Mr. Hopper, provide a chair up here at the table for the Secretary.
In response to your committee's invitation, which I received yesterday, I appear today as a witness for the Navy. Let me assure the committee that any naval officer or enlisted man or any Navy civilian whom your committee wants to hear or who desires to be heard by your committee is completely free to testify. There has been no censorship. There will be none.
Next, Secretary Matthews turned to the case of Captain Crommelin and indicated there were others of like view who spoke out against the defense program as ruining Navy morale.
I have stated that, in my opinion, the general morale of the Navy is good. In that connection, I distinguished between Navy morale generally and the morale of some few individuals who, for reasons sufficient to themselves, have deliberately engaged in the indefensible procedure of surreptitiously disclosing to persons unentitled to possess it documentary and other restricted information belonging to the Department of the Navy in a manner and under circumstances which could leave no doubt of their own consciousness of the impropriety of their action and the disloyal character of their conduct. Those guilty and responsible for imposing this latest blemish on Navy tradition will all be identified and brought to an accounting for their guilty conduct. Therefore, in spite of the deliberately publicized letter of Admiral Bogan and the statement of Captain Crommelin, I believe that, generally speaking, Navy morale is good.
But some members of the committee were convinced that curtailment of Navy power was damaging to morale. Here's how Committee Chairman Vinson phrased it.
Now, one second. I want to put this in the record. That in my judgment, what's disturbing the morale of the Navy are the following facts.
major carriers are being cut. Marine air squadrons are being cut. Destroyers are being cut. Now, Mr. Secretary, in my judgment, those are factors that's affecting the morale of the Navy, as well, probably, as the diehardism of some of the previous advocates against unification.
As Navy Captain Cromlin hoped, senior officers were called by the committee, trying to get at the root of the B-36 fuss. One of them was Admiral Arthur Radford, commander of Pacific Forces. They asked, what did he think of the B-36?
The B-36, under any theory of warfare, is a bad gamble with national security. The plane itself is not so important as the acceptance or rejection of the theory of atom blitz warfare which it symbolizes. It is indeed fortunate that honest doubts as to the adequacy of the B-36 have served to bring this more vital issue before the country. Strategic bombing should be a primary role of the Air Force. However, the United States is not sound in relying on the so-called strategic bombing concept to its present extent. This concept is symbolized by the B-36 delivering the atom blitz. In the minds of our citizens, this fallacious concept promises a shortcut to victory. Our citizens must realize that its military leaders cannot make such a promise. There is no shortcut, no cheat, no easy way to win a war.
And just yesterday, the House Committee summoned a man with intimate knowledge of military aviation. His name, Captain Fred Trapnell, United States Navy Air Force.
Captain Trapnell, come around, Captain, please, sir. Captain, you have been introduced in the prepared statement by Admiral Radford as the commander of the Naval Air Test Center for Tuxedo, Maryland. Have you any statement you desire to submit to the Armed Service Committee?
In open session?
Yes, sir. You're guarding carefully the secret phases of your testimony.
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, let the committee be in order. Your statement prepared?
Yes. Yes.
Give it to the press and give it to the members of the committee.
It is impossible to reconcile the publicity in favor of the B-36... with the reluctance to engage in joint comparative tests with the Navy. This employment of the equipment would be the most valuable possible training for both services. I believe, however, that it will result in cancellation of any further B-36 production.
And there again for the second time, the Navy had thrown a challenge to the Air Force. Let's have a duel in the sky, a mock air battle between the B-36 and fighters like the Navy's sleek Banshee. Captain Trapnell had one final point.
I would like to add, in answer to Mr. Bates' question, that we have requested the Air Forces to let us have B-36s for targets. We have no bomber capable of representing a target at 40,000 feet.
The only reason you don't know more about the B-36 is because you've been denied that opportunity.
That's correct, Mr. Schultz.
We'll take a recess until Monday morning at 10 o'clock, and all witnesses on this day come back.
And that's how it stands right now, this fierce conflict between rival services. Next week, more of the Navy's story. But even though this squabble was showing up big defects in our so-called unification program, the United States went ahead this week in its overall strategy of the Cold War. In Washington, top military leaders of the North Atlantic countries met to review defense preparations. And they heard from Defense Secretary Louis Johnson.
Gentlemen of the North Atlantic Defense Committee, we have no motive other than peace. We in the United States, gentlemen, insist that peace today can be chiefly assured through strength. Our combined military strength and economic strength.
In with all its other anniversaries and celebrations, the nation could note National Newspaper Week.
Oh, there were big doings in Hollywood for this newspaper observance. editors, publishers, advertising men all gather to hear remarks from Holland Palmer, managing editor of the Hollywood Citizen News. And then, Jimmy Durante got into the act.
Stop the presses! Stop the presses! Hand me that rubbing alcohol. Hand me the liniment. Hand me the Turkish towel. I want to give every paper in the country a complete rubdown.
Wait a minute, Jimmy. Who ever heard of giving a newspaper a rubdown?
You know a better way to increase circulation? I got a million of them, a million of them.
Well, Jimmy, at a newspaper gathering like this, we're always glad to welcome a man who's got a nose for news.
I've not only got a nose for the news, I got enough left over for the Times and the Examiner. You know something, Palmer? I've always been associated with newspapers. As a matter of fact, at one time I owned my own newspaper, but I sold it.
How much did you get for it?
3 cents.
Time out this week from the tedious routine of prison life for the inmates of the Texas State Penitentiary.
It's an old custom down Texas way. For the past 18 years, the cowboys who've strayed from the path of law and order stage a big rodeo at the prison. Station KPRC Houston took its microphones to Huntsville to record the flavor of this truly Texas event. Listen as prison manager O.B. Ellis explains the show.
Today marks the opening of the 18th annual prison rodeo. This rodeo had a humble beginning 18 years ago in an open pasture adjacent to the prison. The stock was so wild and the riders so reckless that the news of the Texas prison system's rodeo with its bucking broncos, flying heels, spills, colors, and all the pageantry of performance had spread over Texas and the Southwest.
All right, John Allman of Alice, Texas, calling for his calf. When these men get their horse squared around, call for their calf, the gate swung, the calf gets a little start there in front of him, he slacks back, and there he goes.
Next, the cowboys line up for a square dance.
And now we're just about ready to go, so come on, Senator, put on Cotton Eye Joe. It's 10 o'clock again, all is well.
And so it went on into the night as the inmates celebrated the annual rodeo of the Texas State Prison at Huntsville. One Washington story that had its beginnings last summer came to a belated end this week.
By a vote of 10-8, the Joint Senate House Committee on Atomic Energy decided there was nothing to the case against David Lilienthal and the Atomic Energy Commission. No cause for action in the charges of Republican Senator Burke Hickenlooper, who spoke of security leaks back in early summer of this year.
On May 28, it was reported in the New York Times, in a dispatch from Oslo, that the Norwegian Defense Establishment has been negotiating with the United States for radioactive isotopes. This report is not quite correct. The isotopes had already been sent. The sender is the Atomic Energy Commission. The recipient, you'll note, is not a hospital or a university, but a part of the military establishment of a foreign government. It would torture reason to presume a humanitarian objective in the research conducted by a military establishment.
But to answer this particular charge, the Atomic Energy Commission brought forward its top scientist, Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer.
Well, from what I know of the situation, such a discovery would be of very slight use to the Norwegians, of enormous use to us, and of intermediate use to the British, because the ability to use basic information is largely a question of the vigor of your technology. History again and again shows that we have no monopoly on ideas, but we do better with them than most other countries.
Again, Senator Hickenlooper had accused Lilienthal and the commission of having an unduly high turnover among employees. This, said the senator, was an example of incredible mismanagement. You may recall this answer from Atomic Chief Lilienthal.
And then there were people who left because they died, or they retired under compulsory retirement, or because they had babies. Those who left because they had babies may have been, this may be an evidence of incredible mismanagement, but not on the part of the commission.
Yes, few men in public life have been more harassed by congressional committees than David Lilienthal. But as of today, it appears that he's due for a respite from congressmen, at least for a time.
Again this week, another notable figure of the New Deal and the Fair Deal was under fire by the Congress.
Since 1939, Leland Olds has been a member of the Federal Power Commission, charged with regulating the operation of gas and electric utilities. Twice he'd been confirmed by the Senate for his job, but this week, the Senate was balking at another term. His enemies in the Senate called him a radical, un-American, and used language far more bitter. When a Senate Commerce Committee voted against Olds, Voices and Events asked the commissioner to tell his story in his own words.
I want to tell you why there is this big fight over the president's naming me to a third term on the Federal Power Commission. What I wrote for the labor press a quarter of a century ago, when high finance was driving the country to the Great Depression, is not the issue. I am not a communist. I never was a communist. The chairman of the Senate subcommittee has stated in the record, quote, "There is no one who has testified that he, Leland Olds, is a member of the Communist Party. There is no one who testified he is disloyal to his government. As a matter of fact, we had witnesses all day yesterday who testified how loyal he was," end quote. No, the real issue is just a broadening of the old power issue, with the giant oil and gas industry leading the fight. They are fighting my continued service because over the last 20 years, I have been a leader in the effort to make utility regulation fully protect the public interest and to enable consumers to get ever-increasing supplies of cheap electricity from the people's great water power resources.
The full Senate has yet to vote, but Olds' chances for approval appear to be slim. At week's end, President Truman readied his strongest weapon to back him up, Democratic Party discipline.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history compiled by NBC's News and Special Events Department, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, from the NBC Newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
This week, American industry and its workers are feeling the pinch from the shutdowns in our two basic industries, coal and steel. Mediation had failed in the battle between the CIO steelworkers and the industry. While management campaigns through newspaper ads, Union President Philip Murray is preparing for a personal appearance tour in steel towns to rally support for a pension program paid for entirely by employers. Many this week look to the settlement at the Ford Motor Company, where the CIO auto workers won a so-called non-contributory pension plan. If Ford could do it, they asked, why not other industries? But to this, Ford industrial relations expert Mel Lindquist gives this answer.
We feel our new pension agreement is a good proposition both for the Ford Motor Company and for our employees. It will enable our employees who have long years of service with the company and who are reaching the age when they want to slow down to retire with dignity. Other and newer industries may not have the same problem, and their solution may be a different one.
In the case of both the victorious auto workers and the struggling steel workers, the unions have given up demands for wage increases. But it was apparent this week that such a program is strictly CIO. For William Green, president of the American Federation of Labor, spoke to his members like this.
Our workers are securing increases in wages constantly. For we have determined through an examination of the financial standing of employing interests that many of them can grant increases in wages without increasing the selling price of their products. Labor must share in the earnings of these corporations and share equitably. Then again, we ask nothing, we don't want government boards. We don't ask for government boards. We're opposed to government boards setting our wage standards anywhere or anyplace.
And the coal mines continued idle this week. But tomorrow, exploratory mediation conferences aimed at settling the dispute will continue. Many ask, why did the government mediation service wait so long to step in? Hear an answer from Chief Mediator Cyrus Ching.
It is well known that it is the policy of this service not to interfere with negotiations and to call mediation conferences only when we are satisfied that the parties have reached an impasse or that the public interest and welfare is imminently threatened. The evaluation of all the factors which lead to this conclusion is my responsibility, and it is a heavy one. I am entirely satisfied, however, that the time has arrived when this service must perform its mediation function in the bituminous coal dispute.
100 years ago this week, a giant of American literature died.
He was the father of the detective story, master of tales of the supernatural, and his name was Edgar Allan Poe. In New York this week, present-day writers of science fiction and stories of things to come gathered to launch a new magazine of their works, Fantasy, and to honor the author of The Gold Bug and The Raven. They listened to Basil Rathbone and again the words of Edgar Allan Poe to the story of Annabel Lee.
And this was the reason that long ago in this kingdom by the sea, a wind blew out of a cloud, chilling my beautiful Annabel Lee, so that our high-born kinsman came and bore her away from me, to shut her up in a sepulchre in this kingdom by the sea. The angels, not half so happy in heaven, went envying her and me. Yes, that was the reason, as all men know in this kingdom by the sea, that the wind came out of the cloud by night, chilling and killing my Annabel Lee. But our love, it was stronger by far than the love of those who were older than we, of many far wiser than we. And neither the angels in heaven above nor the demons down under the sea can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabel Lee.
A congressman this week provided a story idea for mystery writers. What would happen if someone discovered the nation's gold hoard was missing from Fort Knox? NBC's Earl Godwin got the story.
Now, here is a gentleman in Congress who does not take anything for granted, and he wants this Congress to find out whether all the gold supposed to be buried at Fort Knox in Kentucky is really there. This is Representative Carol D. Kearns of Sharon, Pennsylvania. And he got to thinking the other day about gold and devaluation and money and all that. And he suddenly became aware of the fact that he had not ever heard of anyone who had seen the government's hoard of gold underground at Fort Knox. And so he put in a resolution today in Congress directing the Banking and Currency Committee of the House to investigate, to find out if the gold is really there. And then that's all from Godwin at this time.
This week, the nation mourned the passing of a grand old man of racing, Colonel Matt Wynn.
Colonel Wynn was Kentucky, a living reminder of a great past. He died this week in Louisville after a lingering illness. Half of his 88 years had been spent in horse racing, taking over a broke and dilapidated Churchill Downs in 1902 and building it into the racetrack of champions. Last May at Churchill Downs, he watched the 75th running of the Derby, the Diamond Jubilee, and Colonel Wynn spoke like this of the Kentucky Derby.
When my father took me to the first Kentucky Derby, it was the first time I had ever been to a racetrack. The great crowd of conveyances from tally-hoes, surreys, buggies, wagons, and drays perhaps impressed me more than anything else. All the derbies stand out in my memories. List of winners is a roll call of champions.
It was one of Colonel Matt Wynn's proudest boasts that during his long association with racing, he never placed a bet. Another giant of the sporting world, gone from the American scene.
Trying as our eventful times are, folks this week gave up just about everything for that annual madness, the World Series. But then, haven't we always when October comes around?
Let's look back on this critical baseball Sunday to some other years. Back on the record of history, we found these words from the first of the great baseball reporters. Just the sound of his voice created excitement. Remember?
This is Graham McNamee speaking, reminding you, in case you've forgotten, that it's baseball time. Yes, the parade's on its way to the old ballpark for the opening game, because this is the day that 150,000 grandmothers decide to die each year so that Johnny can get off to go to the funeral. Long may they live to die and die again, say I. For their imaginary tragedy serves a very good cause indeed. And right now, folks, the game begins.
Yes, the name Graham McNamee meant baseball in the early days of radio. Then, as now, all else was forgotten at World Series time. Let's hear of another great baseball year, 1938. Listen as sportscaster Tom Manning calls the lineup for that series.
Good afternoon, America. Well, the two most eccentric ball players in the game today will be the main points this afternoon. It'll be Dizzy Dean, tall right-hander formerly of the St. Louis Cardinals, warming up leisurely down there now along the third baseline. Over on the other side, El Goofy Gomez, as he is affectionately known throughout baseball.
And this is Lefty Gomez. I'd better say Lefty Gomez 11 years later. Yes, I was pitching for the Yankees back in the series of 1938 when we took it in four straight from the Chicago Cubs. That was a great year and a sad year. It was the last series for the old Iron Horse, Lou Gehrig, and a great year for Joe DiMaggio.
The Yankees will start off with Crosetti at short. Batting in the number two spot will be Red Rolfe. Number three, Tom Henrich. In the cleanup spot, number four, Joe DiMaggio. Number five in the Yankee batting order will be Lou Gehrig.
October the 6th, 1938, the second game of the series. It's the first of the eighth, and the Cubs lead 3-2. And then
Joe DiMaggio at bat. Dizzy Dean still in the box for the Chicago Cubs. Hits the first ball pitch. It's going, 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 going. High and far over the fence in deep left field. And it's a home run for Joe DiMaggio.
And that's how it was, Joe DiMaggio's first World Series home run.
Right, Lefty, Joe's first circuit cloud in the series. And today, well, what do you know? It happened again. If you're following the game this afternoon on NBC television, you heard this on Jim Britt's Gillette broadcast. It's the fourth inning, and
here is Joe DiMaggio. One hit in 16 trips. This is unquestionably Joe's poorest series. And from a physical point of view, too, because he's convalescing from an illness. Ball one. It's amazing that Joe is in the game at all. That missed the corner. 2-0. If it's fair, it's gone. Home run. There's a great comeback. And it's Joe DiMaggio's sixth World Series home run.
But the Yankees had no monopoly on home runs. In the seventh inning, Gil Hodges got one. And the score at that time, Yankees 10, Dodgers 6. That was all for Rashi. Neither side did any damage in the eighth. It's not over yet. There was a delay while the lights were turned on to brighten the twilight shadows. As it stands now, the score is Yankees 10, Dodgers 6. The Yankees only three outs from the 1949 World Series Championship. This has been Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You've heard the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Your editor has been James Fleming. This is Robert Warren speaking, and inviting you to listen next week at this same time for Voices and Events.
Now at last it can be told. Yes, now we can reveal what the governor of North Carolina actually said to the governor of South Carolina. He said, and we quote, "Be sure to hear the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show tonight on NBC." End of quotation. And friends, he's right. It's the true-to-life story of one man's battle against sanity. That's the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show tonight on NBC. You're tuned for the stars on NBC.